Hello and welcome to the Oxford podcast. Today we are joined by Dr. Daniel Kohler, who is the co-founder of the first peer-reviewed open access journal on de-radicalization and the director of the German Institute on Radicalization Studies. To get us started, could you tell us a little bit about what you do and why you've chosen this particular field of study?
Thanks for having me today on your podcast. My background story is really one of bridging practice and theory. So many years ago, like today, I think it's about 10, 12 years ago, I moved from studying violent extremism and terrorism at the university, specifically with a focus on comparative religion, political science, and economics, to really working in the field as a practitioner and helping people to leave extremist environments, working with NGOs, for example. And I realized that when you read about, at least back in the days, it was when you read about terrorism, violent extremism, radicalization processes, especially with the neo-Nazi focus or jihadi focus, researchers had a very particular view of extremists and terrorists, especially the far right. They usually portrayed them as highly uneducated, very violent, drug addicts coming from broken family backgrounds, etc. Specifically in Germany, this was one of the main theories to explain far right radicalization. And when I actually met former far right extremists or people undergoing the de-radicalization process and counseling, they were vastly different from what I experienced in at the university and in studying this, right? So I figured out that, well, there's a lack of actual empirical perspectives and data that researchers really did not really know who they were talking about, writing about. And on the other hand, I figured that in the practical field, especially in Germany and these NGOs and these de-radicalization programs, most of these programs had never heard of evidence-based mechanisms and policies of evaluations of standards. They had no idea what the state of the art was in radicalization research and de-radicalization research. They basically did things because it felt right to them. They did it because they were generally interested in helping these people, but they were really distanced and detached from the research, from the academia. So I figured that for me, one of the most rewarding things to this day is actually to bridge the perspectives of practitioner field and the research academic field. And this really pushed me forward to creating the journal, to creating the German Institute, to work still as a counselor and help to set up programs, to train staff, to help evaluate these programs, but also do research, empirically based research on trajectories into and out of violent extremism.
Can you tell us what concerns you the most about the rise of right-wing extremism and its influence on society?
Well, you are obviously aware that in the last couple of years, especially in Europe and the United States, we've seen a major far right move of many mainstream politics, speaking about the Republican Party in the United States, obviously under the presidency of Donald Trump. We've seen many far right parties entering European governments and European parliaments with some of the latest and the neo-fascist government in Italy. So we have seen a move to the far right politics in democratic countries, which is obviously very concerning. We've also seen in countries like Germany an uptick in far right terrorist violence. I think we are in the middle of a new wave, a global wave of far right terrorism, which basically I think more or less started with the Breivik attacks in Oslo, the Christchurch attacks, and many others. And I think that has something to do, especially with a new form of far right violence and terrorism that has developed over the last couple of years. For example, the lone actor attacks that are accompanied by live streaming of their attacks and publishing a manifesto before the attacks, so using the attack as some kind of a publicity stunt, basically, for their manifestos to become famous saints, quote unquote, in violent far right extremist environments. So this is something that we have seen in Germany and Western Europe and democratic countries. That's extremely concerning. That also these far right terrorists tend to be younger and younger. We've seen cases coming from the Telegram environment, Atomwaffen, Feuerkrieg Division, and others, who are basically 10, 12, 11, 13 years old and plotting terrorist attacks. So they get younger. They are highly transnational, which is also something quite new. A couple of years ago, most of the far right terrorists were located and They were part of their national or local far-right environments. They were socialized within them. They radicalized within them. Their target audience, in a positive sense, who they wanted to impress most, were their local or national far-right environments. While recently, the last couple of years, we saw people who wanted to address a global, transnational, highly online environment on gaming platforms, for example, or on chat boards and imaging boards. Very different psychologically and very different in their radicalization trajectories from what we've seen in the past. So I think that we see a massive widening and development of far-right violence and far-right politics, also driven by an infusion of new conspiracy-based extremist ideologies such as QAnon, incel-based ideologies, many anti-vax, anti-governmental extremism, which is obviously rampant within the far right. So I think that we're entering a new age of far-right violence and politics in democratic countries, sadly.
Yes, that is certainly very distressing to hear. That is also one of the reasons I wanted to bring you on. I do think it's not talked about as much as it should be. I think a lot of the time it's kind of swept under the rug. It's like, oh, it's just a new trend, it will pass. But it's like, it is a concerning thing. Like you said, it's like 10 to 11 year olds, because we now have access to like the social media and people like have it at their fingertips, whereas beforehand they may only have had like influence from their families, and now all of this is just becoming so accessible to people. So there has been a rise in hate crimes across Europe and the world in general. In light of that, do you think that terrorism and hate crimes are close cousins or distant relatives? And is it useful or even necessary to align the two, just to highlight the importance and sort of the danger of what hate crimes really are?
Well, that question of distant relatives or close cousins is obviously a very long-standing one in terrorism research and extremism research, and I wouldn't be able to settle it right now. I would have an answer. Basically, it wouldn't be that difficult, but I think they share certain similarities, hate crimes and terrorism, at least when it comes to the psychological mechanisms. Essentially, the perpetrators want to terrorize, want to scare their victims as part of a larger group. They want to address a larger group behind the particular victim. It's not just about the individual victim. They want to hurt the victim or kill the victim. It's about the group that this victim supposedly is a part of. So that both are communication crimes. Both are acts of violence or threats of violence that are intended to communicate a certain message to a larger group of people to which the victim supposedly belongs. And this message is mainly about creating fear and creating terror and anxiety with a political motive, right? So you want a certain group of people to leave your country or to be afraid of you or to vote in a different way or abstain from voting, for example. So there's always a particular political goal attached to that. And in that regard, I think they are really close cousins. They psychologically they work really similar. But on the other hand, we would be doing a great disservice to terrorism, to understanding terrorism, if we would bring in hate crimes and other associated crimes too closely to that concept. And I think many researchers have pointed out if we really understand hate crimes to be a form of terrorism or closely related to terrorism, that means that much, much more, many more crimes should be considered to be terrorist crimes. By that, we basically water down, washing down the particular phenomenon of terrorism. And as you know, there is no generally accepted definition of terrorism either. So it's very heatedly contested. And I think we should be aware that both of these phenomena, both of these crimes and tactics, hate crimes are crimes, terrorism is a tactic. So there's a first difference there. But in the end, it's really about understanding their particular nature, their particular characteristics or personalities, basically, as an action, as a crime, as a tactic. But I think we should be aware that When it comes to the victims, the psychological effect is very similar. I don't think we should necessarily talk about hate crime as terrorism, but a precursor or a potential earlier stage of terrorism. For example, in Germany, many far-right groups, neo-Nazi skinheads, for example, strategically they use hate crimes, intimidation, physical violence, on a street-based level, on local level, basically to intimidate their opponents, to intimidate their victims. And they are very well aware of the psychological consequences of that. So they use it almost as an international terrorist organization would use terrorist attacks, bombing attacks in the same way, basically. They want to intimidate a whole group of people for their power goals and their political goals. But yeah, I still think we should be well aware of the differences and the particular characteristics to actually understand them better and fight them more adequately.
Do you think that societies in Europe can develop effectively and continue developing without addressing and combating right-wing extremism or just radicalization in general? And do you think that governments currently are doing enough?
I think radicalization and extremism and terrorism are very important national threats or a threat to national security for any country. And depending where this threat is perceived to be coming from, if it's an outsider threat or an insider threat, societies allocate their resources, their personnel and their security, infrastructure, law enforcement, police, intelligence. They allocate budget to different programs to fight these threats. They allocate resources, for example, to hardening up the border security, for example. The political parties, they talk about certain main issues and threats, obviously, because they are important to their voters. So wherever a threat is perceived to be coming from, this has an effect on the whole society of any country that is affected by it. And I think that since 9/11, many Western countries have focused too much on the international terrorism threat, on religious-based terrorism, Islamist terrorism threat, and ne absolutely neglected the insider threat, the threat from domestic extremism and terrorism. And some countries are more or less affected by this neglect. And I would say we currently see the effects of that in the United States, where the whole national security infrastructure for 2 decades basically was almost completely focused on looking outside on the international terrorist threat. And internally, they are at a stage where it's even difficult to actually acknowledge that something as a domestic extremism threat exists, and let alone talking about effective countermeasures. While Germany traditionally had a much longer experience with fighting far-right extremism, and then they branched out to Islamist extremism after 9/11. And so we have a longer tradition. We have even more programs and funding traditionally combating the far right. And other European countries have a mixed record of that. But generally, I think today in the modern age, we as a developing in a country that as a Western democracy, we always continuously have to evolve and have to develop. And I think this is one of the strengths of democratic countries, that we can adjust to new situations, that we can actually think about things and change our policies. And for the last decade, and I would say for the foreseeable future, these internal mechanisms that are also partially stirred up by external agents like Russia, for example, who tries to prey on these internal dynamics and financing and helping to set up far-right groups and stirring up this dissent is something that is extremely important to understand and to build in and to discuss in the public, be it if our countries make terrible electoral decisions, for example, Donald Trump or the Brexit or others, which are clearly also driven by in terms of far-right sentiments, ultra-conservative sentiments, isolationist sentiments, or xenophobic sentiments, at least in Brexit and Donald Trump, obviously there were major reasons for having these people elected or the campaigns being successful. And this is on the one end of the spectrum, but also really coping with the pandemic, coping with immigration, coping with, for example, changes in the society, like gender, for example, even to the language level, coping with the climate crisis, which is traditionally obviously a matter for green left-ish parties, which are now a main enemy of far-right parties and conservative parties. So there's so much being politicized and weaponized, which are basic issues of our societies and of our times, that we as societies and nations should be just talking about and discussing what the solutions of these problems are. So that I fear these are all part of far-right radicalization dynamics. They can be part of it. At least I see it in Germany and in Western Europe and the United States. And they basically hinder our nations to move forward, to find solutions, to come together and rally behind what should be all in our joint interest, like saving the planet. We all need the planet, right? Or just basically preventing large parts of our communities to be excluded just because we don't accept their understanding of gender, their understanding of social community and identity. So there are many, many issues that I feel are part of it and can be weaponized by far-right radicalization dynamics. So I think, yes, absolutely crucial for any future development to take care of these dynamics and think about them.
Thank you. I hadn't even really thought about how much it affects the fact that we can't really talk about issues that should concern all of us because it's been branded as, oh, this is a left-wing issue, this is a right-wing issue. That is very concerning. Thank you for that perspective. Sort of continuing on from one of your points, do you think that in a way sugarcoating and governments and security agencies refusing or being very reluctant to brand what's appear to be right-wing terrorist attacks as terrorist attacks, do you think that's a concern and also is adding to the problem and adding to like the issues caused by these increased attacks?
Well, definitely calling something what it is, if we could agree what it is, that would obviously be very, very, very important. But as long as we disagree what it is, we still cannot agree what terrorism is, mostly, right? So even among the scholars who have studied it for decades, there is disagreement of what exactly terrorism is, or other forms of extremism. So it sounds easier than it is to call something what it is. So I think some kind of contentious debate is part of democracy, is part of a pluralistic society. So the people will disagree if that is actually terrorism or not, if that is far right motivated or not, psychologically motivated, mental health issues, etc. And there are legitimate reasons, arguments to do that, to name an act of terrorism, one act of violence, as terrorism or not terrorism. Plus, it's not just the security agencies who determine that. It's the whole of society who does that. Politicians, journalists, lawyers, judges, the courts, the population as such, when they discuss a certain incident, they are all taking part in a discourse of putting a label on it. And sometimes some certain groups would clearly push for something to be terrorism, but always keep in mind, in Western rule of law based countries, this is nothing that we can just pick and choose. There are legal definitions that can be applied or not be applied. A court of law has to establish the facts. Journalists need to abide by ethical standards. Politicians have certain interests of calling something terrorism or not terrorism based on their partisanship and their political program. So there are many different reasons and many different sides of the story involved. So I think in many cases it's very difficult to define and to really find out what it is. I think there's always obviously a good argument to say, for us as maybe the affected community, or as a population, or as interest groups, we consider this to be terrorism. I think it gets problematic when other institutions in the discourse, like the police, or like the courts, the prosecutors or politicians, when they have come to a different conclusion, they usually have their reasons for it, right? They usually, for example, think that the terrorism statutes can simply not be applied here. Or in court, there was not enough evidence to come to the conclusion that this was terrorism by under our established definitions. And we should, in a democracy, we should at least give them the benefit of the doubt and think that they should have the reasoning behind the argumentation. We should try to understand the reasoning so that we can have a better informed discussion, maybe change the laws and maybe change the definitions, or maybe apply a very specific form of pressure on policymakers that they understand that something is terrorism or it's not terrorism. So we live in our societies in, by definition, in a pluralistic society. So there are different viewpoints. And generally speaking, these viewpoints are, at least they deserve to be heard and they deserve to be discussed when they are not made out of, you know, basically an evil or ill-meaning motive. So I've rarely seen experienced prosecutors or judges or police officers who actually would say, I'm deliberately not calling this terrorism because I want to sugarcoat it, because I'm sympathizing with it, or because I do not want this to be discussed as terrorism. I've never actually seen that. They usually have their reasons, and they usually have very good reasons to do that. So I'm just saying that we need to understand the different sides in that discourse. And the fact that even we as researchers cannot agree on what terrorism is should give us pause if that is really so easy.
Yes, thank you very much. So kind of going off that, do you think that countries and governments should maybe revisit what terrorism means, especially considering that researchers can't really agree on it and there's all these new forms of terrorism in a way? There's new forms of hate crimes, there's more issues being politicized, like for example allowing transgender people to transition into the gender that they identify with, and just in general, do you think it would be worth revisiting the definitions and maybe legal applications of tests and the definitions of crimes when it comes to sentencing and when it comes to the court systems?
That depends on the country. I think what I've seen, for example, in the United States, there has been the argument that the legal statutes are adequate. They just need to be applied consistently and with the full force of the law enforcement and judiciary behind it. Germany has at times increased the penalties. For example, they have added new statutes on a hate motive, for example. So I think it's in most cases, I would suspect, I'm not a lawyer, so I can't really comment on that, but I would suspect that in most cases, the laws are there. The laws are mostly adequate, but they need to be consistently applied. And I've seen in Germany, where I can and speak about, we have obviously counterterrorism laws for decades that were invented basically to fight the left-wing terrorist RAF in the 80s and 90s. In the late 70s even. But they were, until very recently, extremely rarely applied to the far right. And if you would have asked prosecutors and police officers why that is the case, they would have said, well, first of all, it doesn't really matter. They get charged and prosecuted for murder, explosive crimes, whatever, and they even get more sentenced, they get more times in prison than if we would have charged them with terrorism only. Terrorism in the legal code is quite low level charge, right? The people don't know that, but murder and highly, like, very specific crimes, violent crimes, usually rank higher than the terrorism statutes, at least in Germany. So they would say that it doesn't matter. They get more time in prison. And the terrorism definition, in most cases, did simply not apply to the far right because our understanding of terrorism is based on hierarchical groups with a long-term strategy, a political program, very elaborated, and the far right never had that. There were basically many cases lone actors or small cells without a particular political program, no strategy, very ad hoc attacks. So yes, I think it has something to do with our understanding of what the phenomenon is and how it works psychologically, so that we can apply the statutes adequately. It's not so much actually changing the statutes completely. It's actually understanding the terms and the leeway that judges have and prosecutors have to actually go for it and try and argue in court that this is terrorism. And then they learn how to find certain evidence or look for certain evidence in certain cases to make the case, to make the point. And this is more of a question of system learning. The whole system of the judiciary, law enforcement, prosecution, they need to learn how to handle a certain phenomenon. They need to be trained to understand the codes and symbols, the ideology. The judges even need to understand what they're looking at. So it's a system learning issue. And once the system, as in the law enforcement system or the judiciary, has caught up with it, then they generally get more effective in applying their own statutes and laws. So I would stress it's more about actually providing the knowledge and the training to all these significant bits and pieces of the system, from lawyers, prosecutors, police officers, intelligence, judges, that they know basically what the modern far right looks like and what the ideology is and what the codes and symbols are, the language is about different developments, etc. I think that would be more important than revisiting terrorism as such, but obviously we need to be evidence-based. So if the nature of terrorism changes, if we come up with new forms of terrorism that are yet unknown, they should be studied, they should be discussed. I'm a very big proponent of that. 95% of terrorism research in the last 20 years is focusing on Islamist terrorism. So we have very little, actually, comparatively, very little research on far-right terrorism. So we don't really know to a very, very solid degree if far-right terrorism is actually just a different form of terrorism or works completely different. So studying more and discussing it more is obviously something that should not never be stopped. We should always continue discussing it.
So your work as a de-radicalization counselor is extremely important and admirable. What can just everyday people do? How can we spot the signs within our friends and family? What are the first steps that we should possibly like that we should take where possible?
Obviously, that depends a lot on which country you're in. If your country has an established prevention or countering violent extremism infrastructure, if there are counseling programs you can reach out to, if there are trained professionals, you can ask for help. And there are these programs in the UK, obviously. And I know that Prevent and Channel are seen also quite contentiously, and they are heatedly debated. But in international comparison, the UK was one of the first countries actually to start a large-scale PVE, CVE network infrastructure, and they are continuously changing and developing it. They are taking on criticism. And I know many professionals working in the Prevent and Channel program, who are highly dedicated, well-trained professionals who try to serve the communities to the best of their knowledge and their capabilities. So there is an infrastructure in place that I would generally consider or recommend considering using it and trying to get the help. But on the earlier stages, radicalization is a process of change. It's a psychological change process. No one is born an extremist or terrorist. People change to become extremists and terrorists, some of them at least. So it's about what drives them, the grievances, their quest for significance, their search for honor and loyalty and camaraderie. So they're always individual mixtures, like a recipe, like a radicalization recipe. But we know from decades of research and practical experience that people can be resilient against that. For example, the pro-social network matters quite a lot. So friends, family, the stronger you are involved in a wide, diverse network of friends and family and colleagues, the more resilient you are. For example, this would be one protective factor. So just care about human beings in your environment, in your social network. Ask questions, show concern, take part in other people's lives and show that you are there for them as human beings, accept them as human beings. Everyone gets through times where they experience grievances and frustration and anger and sometimes have trauma and other factors that push them off the rails. It's really about showing people that we accept them as human beings, but not necessarily their ideologies or their thoughts, how they try to solve their problems by excluding other human beings, by suggesting violence or using any form of derogatory thoughts and language, for example. So this is just an early start, but I've seen that once people start being more engaged and connect to each other and they are there for each other, they basically accept each other as human beings, regardless what their opinions or the thoughts are at the beginning. This helps quite a lot. But obviously, if you recognize any signs, and this depends a lot on where you are again. If you know what the local signs of the groups are, the language, how radicalization changes people, I always say get help, ask for help, look for professionals, counselors, programs, PV or CV programs, if your country has them. The earlier, the better. The earlier you intervene, the easier it is actually to prevent the person you care about from going down that pathway. So if you can, I would strongly recommend at least considering talking to someone who is specializing in the field and trying to get some ideas and thoughts about how to de-escalate a situation, how to reconnect with the person you're concerned about, and making the right decisions and the right offers at a certain point.
Thank you so much. That is all we've got time for today. Thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to join us and to give this interview.